Corinthians 13. Okay. How are you doing, Dave?
Okay, yourself?
Good to see you.
Good, you too.
I've just been looking forward all week to our time together.
Oh, I got one other thing to tell you real quick. Next Wednesday is going to be...
Thank you for our time together. And we do miss Howard and hope that he's not stalled in traffic and or worse, because it's certainly raining today. And thank you for the three of us. That's enough for you to come and be in our presence, Lord Jesus. And we do want you to teach us from this great chapter in 1 Corinthians, this very unique, incredible chapter that's just full of great things. And so please come and teach us and meet us and touch us in the name of Jesus our Lord. Let me read chapter 13 again. We read it last week, but just to get it back into familiarity. Remember the last verse of the previous chapter is relevant when Paul says, but earnestly desire the best gifts, talking about the spiritual gifts, and yet I show you a more excellent way. So he's going to make a transition here from all that we've learned in 1 Corinthians, which includes the spiritual gifts and about women wearing hats and about the order of the service and a whole lot of stuff. Now he says, all that said and done, I have something better for you. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become as sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know, just as I also am known. Now abide faith, hope, love, these three, but the greatest of these is love. This is such beautiful poetic language that in a sense, as Ray says, it's a shame to try to take it apart. When you can just read this as just an incredibly beautiful narrative. But let's take it apart anyway.
It's got a nice flow to it also.
It does flow well. So I want you guys to, I don't want to give a lecture today or preach a sermon. I want you guys to tell me what you think. So Paul begins in the first verse, even if I were speaking to you, all of you, with the tongues of men and of angels, but I'm lacking in love, then I have become a sounding brass and clanging cymbal. We talked a lot about tongues, which we decided meant primarily languages. But here he says tongues of men and tongues of angels. We don't know anywhere in the Bible that tells us how angels communicate with each other. We do suspect that the angels have a unique language where they talk to each other that we would not understand. And we've talked about, I think here he's talking about, even if I knew every human language there was to know and every dialect and every utterance, and I also understood how the angels talk, which he obviously doesn't, then if I did all this, then I would stand up and I would explain everything in one of these tongues. But he says that I don't claim that. And if I did stand up and claim those credentials, but I was lacking in love, then I'm just like a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. Now that musical instruments in ancient Babylon were bagpipes and percussion instruments like drums or gongs that clanged. They didn't necessarily pay harmony. So you've heard a fire engine run down the street, clang, 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 because they have bells on them and they have whistles. Clang, clang, clang in the middle of the night. And sounding brass could be a brass instrument in the orchestra that's not being played very well. That's kind of, you know, if you don't know how to play a bugle and you just pick it up and sound in it, it's going to come sounding pretty discordant. So his introduction is here, I don't care what kind of credentials a man has or where schools he's been to or what he says he's good at, I'm going to listen to him and I'm going to evaluate what he says on the basis of what I detect about him loving or not loving. How many sermons have we heard that don't connect to us, that are just noise or clanging cymbals or discordant, that we just think of something better to do while the sermon's going on? A lot of times, even if the preacher is well-intentioned, he may not know himself very well. He may not be God's instrument to speak what God wants us to hear. So Paul is sort of saying, look, if you're going to stand up and represent the living God of the universe, then it's imperative that you understand who that person is, because that person is love. God is love, and everything he does is love. The word, we talked about the four words for love in Greek, eros, storge, which means natural affection, which is you like your favorite pair of slippers, as C.S. Lewis would say. That's storge. It's affection. I have affection for my cat. I really like my cat. But philia is the next highest level of, which is tender love among the brothers. Because you like somebody, you care about them, then that's friendship. We don't have a lot of friends in today's world. We're too scattered. Do we have anybody we can trust? Well, the word for love that he uses here is agape, which means the self-giving love that God has as inherent in his nature. God is love. Whoever loves is born of God. And so if you have a real connection with Jesus and you really understand that he's love and you want him to speak through you and to you, then that's what this chapter is all about. Okay? It all makes sense? Now, he goes on in verse 2. Please, you guys got to jump in here. Though I have the gift of prophecy, that we talked about that. That's the ability to teach the scriptures in depth. The ability to charge up your audience like the nervous system of the body does. The ability to wake up sleeping congregations from the dead by not prediction so much as it is expounding the deep things of God and getting people, oh my goodness, I didn't know the Bible said that. The pastor teacher doesn't specialize in those things, but the prophet does. If I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. So he says here, understand all mysteries. That would be a mystery, is a truth that was previously hidden but now is made known. And that would be that you understand all the mysteries. There's seven or eight mysteries in the New Testament. The mystery of the nature of Christ is one thing. Could you talk about the fact that Jesus is both God and man? That's called kenosis, and that's a hotly debated subject among theologians, is how could a person be both God and man and in the same body? Well, that's a huge issue. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, they tend to assume they're monophysites. They think Christ has only one nature, that he's the Son of God. They don't pay any attention to his humanity. We, on the other hand, insist that Jesus is both God and that he's also man. So that would be one of the mysteries. Now, Paul is saying here, Paul probably did understand all the mysteries that are in the Bible, but he says, doesn't matter. That's not where my real credentials are. Because Paul was well educated. He knew the Old Testament very, very well. He argued, before he became a follower of Jesus, he argued against all heresies among his fellow Jews, and he hunted down and persecuted and jailed the followers of Jesus because he considered Christianity to be a cult. Until on the road to Damascus, he had that great experience when Jesus appeared to him and said, "Paul, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And this blinding light came, and he was struck blind for several days. Anyway, so he's saying, look, what really counts is not your gifts or your talents or anything else. It's whether or not you are a channel of God's love, whether you have given your body as a living sacrifice to Jesus so that he, Jesus, is free to love everybody through you. That would mean everybody, which is right. Now, that's we don't know how to love at all, I don't think. We try to love, and it turns out that we're lusting or we're selfish or we want something would be rewarded. Or prostitutes sell their bodies for, quote, love, but we know it's not love. Your best friend might betray you, which is not love. So this chapter is about sorting out what's really love and what's not. Because we cannot love people in the flesh beyond a certain superficial level. It's great to have people that like you, that are your brothers and your sisters and your family members, but that's not a guarantee that they agape you, right? Yeah. So we all have a affection for our parents and our siblings and for the people we work for. We get along with our employers and we get along with our relatives, even if they hate Jesus, because God does not want them to perish. He does not want anybody to perish, and he is occupied in tracking down people of all backgrounds, particularly the poor and the needy and the bankrupt, right? Mm-hmm. And he's the hound of heaven. Somebody, there's a great poem about the hound of heaven, that Jesus, like a hound, the hounds that the police department has that chases down the fugitives. So this, bloodhound. You turn the bloodhound, you give the bloodhound a handkerchief or a piece of clothing from the person you want to hunt, and the bloodhound takes a sniff and charges out to find that. The person generally does find him. Even if it's the trail is old and he has to go through the forest, the bloodhound will find the guy and bark loudly and allow you to come and arrest that person. Well, Jesus is the hound of heaven in the sense that he's pursuing us all. Even those of us who know Jesus are being urged by God to grow and learn and enjoy Jesus more and die to self and all that. But the lost, I really had this last week, I've really come to see how God loves everybody in the world passionately. That in eternity, Jesus died for everybody. And it doesn't matter how badly you've messed up in life. In fact, it may even be positive, it may be even helpful if you screwed up real bad, because you may realize you need Jesus more than the rich man or the, okay? Now, so Paul says, if I don't love, or if I'm not a channel of God's love, I don't amount to anything. In fact, I could be doing more harm than good by misrepresenting God, like a lot of preachers do. Okay, verse 3. Now, somebody take verse 3 and explain that. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Mother Teresa type person. Not to demean that wonderful woman who was in the Calcutta suburbs and took care of the dying. She had a sanitarium for people who were dying. She'd pick them up on the street. And she didn't try to get them well. She just wanted to make them comfortable so they could find God if possible. And then she'd be there till they died. Pretty, you know, ordinarily we run a healing clinic to save people who we hope will get well. But not Mother Teresa. She was there for the dying. And in India, there's 10,000 people on the streets at night. They have no home or they live in a cardboard box. When they get old and they are ready to die, they will die on the street. A truck will come along and pick up all the bodies every morning and put them in the town crematorium. And so much, that's the end of your history as far as Calcutta is concerned. Well, anyway, what else is in this verse? Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned, that could mean several things.
Well, all of those things sort of have a common thread to them, I think. They, they're ways to show the love of God to somebody that hasn't got a relationship with God yet.
Yep.
And I think this is saying you can do all these wonderful things, but if you don't have the right motive and in particular if you're not doing it in your own heart from the place of agape love, then it's all for naught. As far as I'm thinking in, you know, things like when we answer, we're standing before the judgment bar of God and being held accountable, I guess, to Him for what we did in our life. If we did these things without love, without a pure motive,
mm-hmm.
then it counts for nothing in terms of rewards in heaven.
Self-serving.
You're going to suffer some degree of loss.
That's right.
In eternity.
Occasionally in history we see the horrible story of some devout Buddhist or somebody that pours gasoline on his head and lights it up, and self-immolation is what it's called.
You saw that happen during Vietnam War.
It did.
Yep.
And is that a way to express your self-sacrificing nature to get attention? Or what about getting burned at the stake, which is not voluntary, versus self-immolation, which is voluntary? Not everybody dies from that, because sometimes people rush in, put the fire out, and smother you in blankets, and you go to the burn ward for an agonizing recovery. But anyway, what about those you guys, those examples?
To me, that's just, you know, basically more of the same kind of, the idea is if these things are being done for it's not what they're being done for, but if they're being done with a less than pure motivation,
okay, yeah,
in the eyes of God,
yeah,
according to His standard,
yeah, that's good.
Then then again, it's gonna come to nothing. If at the core of it, love, agape love, is not at the core of it, then yeah, you're gonna suffer loss.
That's good, Dave.
That's fine.
So your motives do matter. Are there people that are very generous in giving money to the poor from wrong motives? Yes, there are. How about very rich people? They have to give their money away, And they're going to look far better if they give it to a recognized charity. And they don't really care. I got to get rid of $10 million because my taxes will be too high if I don't. So I'm just going to give away this much. And somebody's going to help me get the most publicity out of that. I'm not going to talk about that because I don't want people to know that I gave $10 million to the Red Cross or to the homeless poor in Timbuktu. But we're easily self-deceived. I think you could all agree with that. Okay? But, so, this means that when we are loving somebody or we're being an instrument of God, we love them and help them and then leave it there. We don't hang on to whether that person gets well and then we get credit for it, or whether they die and we could have done more. That's not in the equation.
It needs to be selfless.
That's right.
And not selfish in any way.
Verse 4, love suffers long and is kind. Now here we're going to get a whole bunch of the things that love is not, a whole bunch of them. So what we're told right up front is love suffers long and is kind. Then we talk about all the negative things that love is not. So love suffers long and is kind. What does that mean? Long-suffering? Bearing with?
Yep. If you're coming from that core motivation, it's going to manifest itself, the agape love, as, you know, like being the long suffering. I think of, you know, just tolerating things that normally the natural man would have a hard time tolerating. And I struggle with that kind of stuff every day on my job.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that...
And that's not to say that, you know, most of the kids that I have are really well-behaved, but there's always a few that, you know, have whatever their problems are in their life or at home or with their parents or other authority figures in their life. It manifests in sometimes some pretty obnoxious ways. So
there are quite a few people in the world who are married to somebody who's terminally ill or handicapped or disabled.
That's a good one too. Yeah.
Maybe you had a really great marriage for 10 years and then your wife came down with cancer. And you want her back and you want her well, and that may happen, but you're gonna hang in there with her, and you're gonna be there for her, and you're gonna go out of your way to make sure she's comfortable and fed properly and got the best doctors, and you're gonna be very much into agape love, right? Okay. Now all the things that love is not are here. Does not envy. Wow. Does not parade itself, is not puffed up. Those are really interesting terms.
There's a story in the Bible that, that last part especially, kind of illustrates, which is the the story of Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah.
And the rather less than pure way in which they gave, you know, a
proceeds from a real estate
monetary
check.
Gift, yeah,
uh-huh.
To the church, and
got struck dead.
Yeah, they got made an example. Well, they didn't exactly time it very well, and
no.
because it was early in the church,
yeah,
you know, God had to make an example of them, I guess, you know.
I think so. They might have gone straight home to heaven. We don't know.
I think they were, you know, they were genuinely saved people.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they were messed up in some areas when they did it the way they did it, they brought down some pretty severe judgment on themselves.
It's interesting that whatever they gave to the congregation was voluntary. They didn't have to give anything. But they lied about what they did give, and that was the
biggie. That was what put them over the top.
So, long-suffering, love is kind. You know, that's when you're loving somebody who needs to be loved and encouraged, are you being kind? Or are you being judgmental? Or, oh, here's the medicines that you ordered, I got them for you, and boy, you made me late for dinner tonight. And you see, that would be unkind.
Yeah.
It would not be consistent with the fact that I said, I care about you. It would not be, you betray your, so that's what, love does not envy, love does not parade itself. Oh, guess what? I just went to the old folks' home today, and I put in 4 hours helping those dear old folks. And boy, did God use me a lot. And I'm really good at that. And gosh, there's nothing like visiting an old folks' home and visiting those dear old people, because, boy, they don't get very many visitors. And so I've got a gold star. You see how that's fake. You don't necessarily really care about those people. You don't dare get too close to them because they've got pus and sores all over them, and they're out of their minds, and their breath is bad, and they're dying, say. So, does not parade itself. Well, that would be, parading yourself would be bragging and taking credit for what God's done through you, and wanting God to pay you back for the time you spent, and wanting some kind of a selfish reward, or even maybe want the patient.
False pride.
Yeah, it's false pride.
Which God really doesn't like.
No. Puffed up. My footnotes say it does not brag, is not jealous, does not parade itself. So all those things are things that love does not do. So those are all negatives. There's a whole bunch more. Does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil. Yeah. You believe the best for everybody you love. They may be very screwed up and overpowered with lust or selfishness or pride, and you kind of have to overlook that. People that are full of anger and selfishness and lust, they're very detestable people as far as you can tell. It doesn't matter, you just go ahead and love them anyway with that love of Jesus, which is compassionate. You don't have to bring up the faults you may be aware of. You don't have to solve all their problems in one fell swoop. Swell swoop.
The truth is, we more often than not can't solve their problems anyway.
That's right.
And when we try to do it ourselves, we usually just end up getting in the way of God.
Yeah, and so
what are the kind of work God's doing in their behalf?
That's exactly, you know? Right. I like that. Okay, Dave? Okay. Does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil. You don't believe that that person is going to be forever selfish and stubborn and proud. You believe and you hope that God's going to use you in a long process. He's going to use a lot of other people too, and hopefully that person who's so beyond hope right now will eventually come to know Jesus, have all their sins forgiven, and be made into a whole new person. That's what you're after. So you don't want to try to anticipate what God's doing. That's really not your business.
Best thing you can do is all those things you just listed is pray for those things for that person.
That's exactly right, yeah. So that's what...
Easier said than done sometimes.
Oh, it is. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. When we hear awful, shameful, ugly things from non-Christians, we should keep quiet about it. We don't want to defame that person's integrity or their person or think less of them. We may have our own opinions and our own observations. There may be nothing good in that person that we can tell, but that's, we don't go and tell all our friends, oh, you know, Joe is really a messed up, screwed up person. He's never going to know God. You don't do that. You may think, wow, this guy's a tough case. Yeah. This old lady is really stubborn. But you just keep that to yourself. Let's see that.
We don't know anyway what.
We don't what's know what God. If God can save you and save me and save us, then that's pretty incredible. Because I never should ever be a Christian. Okay, verse 7. Love. Now we're back to some positive things. After all, love's not. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. That's a wonderful thing. It marks the what real love from Jesus is all about. Bears all things. Believes all things, hopes all things. Endures all things. Put up with an awful lot of nonsense. Put up with a stubborn, rebellious counterattack. People that are very selfish. People that get angry or resentful because the truth has stung them. And they think it's all your fault. Boy, I'll never love you ever. You are a real loser with your religious phoniness. Oh, get lost. We're going to get those attacks on us all the time. What do? Well, you just remain under, hupomene, under rower, just ride through the storm.
I got a question about one of the items in the verse 7. The one that says, believes all things.
Believes the best.
Okay, that's what I was going to... In other words, it would be... You would somebody makes a certain claim, you give them the benefit of the doubt, how can I say? In other words, you don't air your, even if you have doubts, you don't air those doubts. You give them the benefit of the doubt, or you choose to believe the best about them,
and I think something becomes
you know.
If we have a real relationship with somebody, that's personal and some degree of trust on both sides, then the other person has freedom to open up and share. You know, I've never told anybody this before, but when I was 5 years old, I stole a motorcycle and I rode all over town and I ran over some pedestrians and I was only 5 years old. But please don't ever tell anybody this, because this is my deepest, darkest secret. You're going to get people that confide in you where they've never confided in anybody else, and you don't say, oh, that's sick. Or that's an incredible fairy tale. That isn't true. You don't do that. You say, you withhold judgment, in other words. That would be listening to what that person says, especially if they're trusting you, especially if they're transparent, because people are not normally transparent when they're sharing their deep, dark secrets.
And this is a kind of a description of what it looks like to be a safe person for that.
Safe person, that's exactly the right word.
Yeah.
And so a safe person is a pretty rare thing today, to be safe to people that may know you're a Christian, but they hate God, or... You know, to get people to treat you as safe is wonderful. Can you be trusted? Can you keep a secret? Well, yeah, sure. Now you hear this horror story coming out of somebody who doesn't know Jesus, and your tendency would be, oh, gosh, you're really messed up. Let me give you the name of my psychiatrist. Maybe he can help you. I can't help you anymore. You wouldn't say that. You'd say, well, can I pray for you? Or, gosh, I was at least that screwed up when I was your age. You don't know my story and what I've been forgiven of. So thank you for sharing, and thank you for trusting me, and I want to be worthy of your trust, and I would like to pray for you right here and now, because you got an invitation to pray for that person, probably. Hi, Kitty. Kitty cat, Lord, would you please keep the kitty cat from hassling my brother Dave? Okay. So we believe the best out of people that we have no reason to believe that by our natural thinking. Love never fails. And that would be, that comes back full circle to the love of Jesus never fails. It never does. Ever. It may take a long time till people realize that that we're not ordinary mortals, that we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power might be of God and not of us. And so I think we have to, God is not going to waste my time or his time. Anytime he uses us, it's not wasted.
And that means in spite of all the problems that come along the way through the process of sanctification.
Yeah. And there are people that are going to hate us because we represent Jesus, and they hate God, and they maybe always will hate God. That doesn't matter. That I think that makes Jesus weep over the weeping of Jesus over one sheep, one person that is lost. He doesn't want people to be lost, no matter what it takes. All right. Whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will pass away. So he's talking about life's ending or the end of the age or when the debates are all over and said and done, and we see the end of our lives and we see the end of the people that we witness to, and it's all in God's hands. And not only that, but all the things we learned in Sunday school don't count so much anymore. That was all true stuff we heard. It was real good knowledge. I had some great Bible teachers. But, gosh, the love of Jesus is so much better. So I can rest. I can rest in the indwelling Jesus. And so at the end of history, when we stand before God, how our speaking abilities, our abilities to prophesy, our preaching, our languages, they're all going to be irrelevant. The end of history, push comes to shove, if there's a nuclear attack, the books we own, the property we have, not very relevant. So, okay.
Especially in its vaporized state.
If we get vaporized, yeah, and we see the missiles coming in, we've got a split second to say, okay, Jesus, I'm out of here.
That puts new meaning on life as a vapor.
What is your life but a little mist which appears for a short time and then vanishes away?
Literally, that's what it was.
Instead, you shall say, if God wills, we shall do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Whoever knows what is right to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. So that's James.
Okay. He doesn't leave you much wiggle room, does he?
No, he doesn't. And, you know, when it's time to die, and we have a split second to make up our mind. I have a hunch that time slows down, and that last breath may be an eternity in our awareness and God's awareness. And, okay, and God's saying, okay, you make up your mind because we're at the end of your rope now. Are you with me or are you against me? And so we get those deathbed conversions of a lot of people, I think. Now we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part shall be done away. The word perfect is really the word complete. It doesn't mean sinless perfection. It means finished. It means full circle in our lives. It means okay, you're a grown up man now. You can come into heaven. That's the idea. You finish the race. It doesn't mean you don't have any flaws or shortcomings or inherent evil, because we all do. So this is talking about dying and going to heaven in one sense. It's talking about when Jesus comes back to take over the world and he's visible to the whole world, it's too late to be on the fence. Okay? When that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. So that's where we're all headed, is inevitable. It's going to happen. It's going to happen in history. It's going to happen in our own lives. Okay?
The term in part, is that another way of saying temporary?
Yeah. How much do we know of Jesus right now? We've never seen him. I've never seen Jesus. His disciples saw him. They ate with him. They traveled with him. They walked around Israel for all that time, 3 years. And they knew him, what he looked like. They hung on every word. They came to be startled that they realized this was no ordinary man. We don't have that benefit of that. We may catch glimpses of Jesus in other people, but they're glimpses. But we know Jesus, right? No question. And what did Jesus say about blessed are you who believe but have not seen, or something like that?
He's talking to Doubting Thomas.
Yeah. Thomas was not so much a skeptic as he wanted to check out everything before he committed himself. That's fine. Because you don't want to make a false commitment if you don't know to whom you're making that. So he had to research and meditate and pray. And it took him an extra week. You remember when Jesus was raised from the dead and walked on the road to Emmaus and had dinner with his disciples in Emmaus, west of Jerusalem. Thomas was not there. And he had to wait a whole week. And the next time Jesus met with his disciples was a week later on Sunday night. And Thomas was there. And Ray Stedman says, that just goes to show you what happens if you miss the Sunday evening service. Because at the second week, Thomas was there. And Jesus said to him, look, check my wounds and see I'm not a ghost, and have some dinner with us, and I'm your friend, and I love you. And Thomas then was persuaded, became the great apostle to India. Started the Martoma Church in India. Great. A 2,000-year-old church. Still there. Church of Martoma. Mar means saint, and Toma is Thomas, St. Thomas. So that's Doubting Thomas. But he's just careful about what he puts his trust in. That's all right.
That church is actually in Pakistan, isn't it? Because that used to be, you know, way back, that used to be, maybe not that far back, but it used to be part of India.
That's true. The Pakistan resulted from this division, this civil war in India, in which the Muslims and the Hindus got into big fights. And the Muslims all went up north and formed Pakistan and made it into a very ferocious Islamic republic with a great deal of hostility towards the Hindus in India. The Hindus are generally very gentle, and they don't go in for all the rhetoric of Islam. So the border crossings are very carefully guarded, as I remember.
But Pakistan, I think, is the area in India where Thomas ministered.
He landed in Cochin on the west coast of India, which is a separate country, I think. And Cochin is, the ancient relics are there, but the church generally settled in South India.
That's the part that's Pakistan today, I think. Right?
No, Pakistan's in the north.
Oh, it is? Okay.
No. The church in South India...
Geography is a week for me.
India is only about 5% Christian, and it's Hindu and Muslim, and every known religion in the world is there. All these sects. Zoroastrianism, they have a fire temple with the eternal flames in it. They've got the Towers of Silence where they put their dead bodies so the vultures can eat them up. Now, the Christians...
I thought Zoroaster was more Persian, maybe.
It is.
Yeah.
So the Persian religion has got a planting in India.
Oh, okay.
So the Christians now, after St. Thomas, they spread out over all India. They evangelized the whole country, so there are pockets of Christians everywhere. And then when the British ruled India, they brought along a lot of Christian evangelists. The British recognized that India had 200 languages, and so they tried to get it down to one language, common language of English. The whole country was all fragmented by villages and so on, and the British put in the railroad system and the telephone system, which are now archaic, and they built an army, and they tried to unify India. They finally gave up and pulled out and let India be independent back in the, 40s, 30s? And that India became a republic, but the leaders in India have tried to manage this diversity of languages and this diversity of religions, and they don't particularly give any favoritism to India. As a matter of fact, the foreign missionaries are generally not allowed into India, Christians.
Really?
If you go in there on your own as a Christian, you're free to do whatever you want until you start a riot or something. And there are pockets, like in the south end of India, which has a very tropical, wonderful climate. I think we have no Howard today.
Okay.
So we have to eat normally.
All right.
Anyway, that's India. So, are we going to go a little further, Dave?
Yeah.
Yes. Now, when that which is perfect has come, that would be in heaven, for example. In heaven, we don't need to have people expounding the Bible to us, because Jesus will be there. We'll see him. We'll be like him. Our friends, our family members, if they've met Jesus, will be there. We can travel to distant planets if we want. We can hang out with our great-grandmother. We can go meet the apostles and the Christians. The church we're in now is 2,000 years old. It's a living body. We say we're in the body of Christ. We are connected not only to Jesus, but we are connected to 2,000 years of people who believe just like we believe. Well, that's going to be quite a exciting time, because we know a lot about church history. We know about all the heresies and all the controversies and all that, but in the middle of all that, there are people just like us who trusted Jesus, ordinary people, each with a unique experience. Dave's experience is my experience, or Dwayne's experience, or Howard's. Everybody's got their own story to tell. So it's kind of exciting to think about being part of the body of Christ, which has been being built member by member for 2,000 years. It's a true living church. This is not PBC in this century. It's the roots. You may not be aware of those roots, but 2,000 years of Jesus building the body and calling his bride, same imagery that we study here. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. Well, children have this wonderful innocence about them. We all start to talk and walk at what, age 3 about? We're pretty helpless for the first year of life. We got to be changed and fed and put to bed, and we got to be diapers changed. We got to stop screaming so we don't keep our parents up all night long. We're just a little bundle of. Ray said, "A loud noise at one end and a mess at the other." That's Ray. So he kind of knew what little babies are like. They're awfully adorable and cuddly, but that's where we started. Now, we got a little older, and our parents began to put boundaries around us. Don't go out in the cold without my permission. Sit down. Listen, I told you 1,000 times that I don't want you doing that. If you do that again, I'm going to spank you until you really hurt. You're never going to get a licking like I'm going to get you. And if you don't do that, you've got an unruly, undisciplined, spoiled brat on your hands who's going to cause you a lifelong problem. So you got to break that self-will when it shows up. And you got to protect that kid from predators and from the dangerous world out there. You got to build a playpen for them, and you got to give them toys, and you got to teach them how to walk and talk and how to use language and spell and write, and kids eat that up, but it's simple.
My favorite subject or story about that was from a mother who was appearing on the Focus on the Family radio program. And she, I thought she took it to the bottom line. She says, you know, an infant before it can speak or even you know, have a whole lot of self-awareness even.
Yeah.
The kid knows how to communicate.
Yeah.
You know, one really bottom line thing, which is, whenever you hear wah 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 wah, if you were to put that into words, it would be, it's all about me. It's all about me.
It's true. Very selfish.
Well, I mean, it's like it's showing just how what do you call it? Fundamental the human condition is. Yeah. I mean, it's what we are.
It's what we are. We're
starting right at the very beginning.
Right. So, yeah, I'm the center of the universe, and you, Mom and Dad, you better learn that, because I'm going to show you.
Right.
I'm going to manipulate and deceive you and lie to you, because I want...
That's what comes natural to us in that state.
It does. But parents that know what they're doing will laugh at our folly and protect us and spank us and rope us in, and we don't generally get to go out of the house on our own at first. Dad's the one that's supposed to take us on walks, and if you're a boy, take us for walks and hikes in the forest and show us the things that men do and take us to the football game and whatever. If they don't do that, they've really not performing as fathers are supposed to do. Mothers are not supposed to overprotect their kids, which it's easy for mothers to do. They just, oh, you hurt yourself today. Oh, my baby. Oh, I'm so sorry. 12-year-old, and he scratched his knee.
My job gives me a front row seat to all of that transition.
Okay.
There's a family that is at church, and their kids, you know, were, you know, crossing my intersection every morning. And,
yeah.
And, you know, like, when they first start... like, I mean, I've got them from preschool on up, you know, coming through my intersection, right? So, you know, sometimes the first time I see a kid, oftentimes, you know, it's the parent, you know, walking the kid to school and then walking Leaving down them. To pick them up when school is over with.
Yeah.
And that goes on for several years.
Yes.
And then recently this couple that has several children that goes to our church, I think they're Chinese, but anyway, they I didn't see them for a while, so then one day I saw them, the mother walking their dog by herself, and I said, I haven't seen you guys for a while. She said, yeah, the kids are old enough now, they can walk themselves to school and back, so that's why. She's supposed to see at church.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got a kick out of that.
That's good. Now, Mom and Dad have a certain belief system. They may not know Jesus. They nevertheless want the best for their kids, or they want the kids to do well in life. And some parents are very happy to have you leave home because you're a pain, and you're an expense, and you're eating expensive food now, and you should have left home when you were 17 or 18. And what are you doing home when you're 35? Or so, you see, what codependency, we'd say. So, most parents recognize that the kids are going to leave. They hopefully they will embrace your system of beliefs, because the parents are going to instill some kind of right and wrong values in you, some sort of programming of your conscience so that you do well in life. That usually means they want you to be successful and wealthy and happy. They want you to marry a good woman and have great kids, so they can be grandparents in due time, because they proud grandparents are going to say, oh, look, we raised our kids just right. Look how they've all turned out. Well, that's pretty iffy if the parents don't know Jesus. If they do know Jesus, they probably are narrow-minded in some areas, like Baptists or Methodists or whatever. So the kid's going to grow up and go to school, and he's going to get find out that the Baptists aren't perfect and the Methodists aren't perfect, and my parents were not perfect, and they meant well, but gosh, I've thought things through, and I've got my own belief system. I'm going to be a Muslim, or I'm going to be a Buddhist, because I like this way of peace. So that's why we've got this society with so much diversity. Even with the very best of parents who pray for you every night, who tuck you into bed, who read you the Bible, doesn't guarantee that you are going to make good choices or that you're going to consider this Jesus they keep talking about, because that's not what we're basically. We're basically very sinful, very selfish. We want the world owes us a living now. I've been to college, had graduate school, and I've learned all about history and religion and philosophy, and this Jesus guy just doesn't fit into my worldview. Period.
That's a good way to put it.
Well, that's the real world. But on the other hand, it might be that in college I met a Christian who showed me love and befriended me when I was really in turmoil on the inside, because I was collecting the payoff from sin, and I was drinking too much, and I was sleeping with my girlfriend, and I've got this emptiness inside, and I'm hiding it really well. I'm the valedictorian of my class, and everybody admires me. The girls all flock around me because they want to date me. But if they only knew.
The world is my oyster.
Yeah. And then, so at any time in our lives growing up, Jesus may interfere with our plans by crashing into our pagan worldviews and letting us know what's really going on. And so it's never too late to pray for somebody or to hope for the best for them. And so we never give up on anybody, no matter how their life appears to be beyond hope.
Till they draw their last breath.
Yeah. For now we see in a mirror dimly. Ancient mirrors were not like silver mirrors that we have today, where you get a look in the mirror and you get a very clear picture back. The ancient mirrors were polished brass, highly polished. So if you looked in this mirror, all the women had mirrors to put their cosmetics on, but the mirrors did not give a very good image. So you wouldn't know if you got your lipstick on crooked or you're powdering the right place or whatever. So that's what he says here. Now we see through a glass. We see in a mirror darkly, ancient mirrors. But then face to face. Now that's a beautiful picture of the fact that we all need mirrors in our lives to have. We need other people to tell us the good and the bad, discreetly. Oh, you're just as beautiful as the day I married you, you say to your wife. Or you haven't aged a bit. Or, you know, we compliment women, especially. We compliment, hey, you're looking great, Dwayne. Man, you're really good. Dave looks good. So that's looking through a glass darkly, because I can't read your inner hearts, but Jesus can. He's the only one that knows your motives, why you do what you do. And when we see him face to face, we all with open face beholding the glory of the God, glory of God, are being changed into the same likeness from one degree of glory to another. All this is from the Lord who is the Spirit. So that's kind of scary to realize that we're going to look at Jesus face to face, and he's going to look into our hearts with his piercing eyesight, and he's going to say, I love you. I paid for all of your sins. I want to be your friend. I'm not angry at you. I care about you. I've always loved you. Thank you for letting me love you. See, that's going to be, then I shall know, understand, be aware of, just as I've also been known. God knows everything about us right now. We don't know very much about each other. We know a little bit because we're willing to be vulnerable, but
There's one comforting thing about all of that. I mean, it's pretty terrifying what you're describing. But the one comforting thing is that the scriptures also say that when we come to the point where we're able to see him face to face as a saved person, that we will be instantaneously made like him, or yeah. made perfect, in other words. So
yeah.
so
when we see we'll be like him.
What's been going yeah. on, where we've been, you know, chronically doing all these, you know, it's like Paul's description, you know, I know the right thing, but I always end up doing the wrong thing.
Good that I do not want doing what I do. And
yeah.
The, yeah.
That comes to an abrupt halt.
It does.
Ends. And it never to come back again. And so from that point forward in eternity, I think that's gonna enhance our relationship with him.
And it's gonna be all good. It's all gonna be good. It's not gonna be horrible.
Yep.
Courtroom scene.
We'll be able to relate to him, you know, on the same moral level for the first time.
Yeah. Well, and the glimpse of that ahead of time is that the more we are transparent with one another, the more we trust one another, the more that we feel good, we feel forgiven, we feel affirmed, we feel loved, we feel Jesus is at work right here.
Yep.
The last verse says, now, for the present time while we're waiting, abide faith, hope, and love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Now, he's got three things here that abide: faith, hope, and love. That's a kind of a trinity. Faith, we're trusting Jesus whom we have not seen. We hope for our full acceptance and freedom from guilt and pain and sorrow. And among all of these is love. So if we practice loving, then we know that Jesus is the source of that love, and that is our hope, then we don't need to be afraid of anything.
Yep.
So that's... Dave has been silent, which is okay. That was an hour and 15 minutes. We still have time. I think Dave's... I don't know how Howard's going to catch up with us here. Miss Howard. Do you know what's been going on with Howard this week?
Sunday he mentioned that, you know, that he might need a substitute Bible teacher, and I'm usually the one on call when that happens.
Okay.
So,